33 degrees Kenosha, 32 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. All this week on WGTD's morning show, we are replaying for you some of the most noteworthy author interviews that were recorded and initially broadcast back in 2022. And here is yet another rebroadcast that we hope you will enjoy. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be talking football today and talking about one of the most extraordinary achievements in the history of the NFL. The one and only time that an NFL team has gone an entire season from the very beginning all the way to the league championship game without a loss or a tie. That has only happened once. And it is something that I remember. I was 12 years old at the time when the Miami Dolphins went 17-0. And as a matter of fact, that is the title of the wonderful new book that has been written about that extraordinary season. Marshall John Fisher's book is called 17-0, Miami 1972 and the NFL's only perfect season. It's a book in which he examines not only all that was part of that amazing success story, the talented ball players and all of the ways in which they needed to come together and meld as a unit under the leadership of Coach Don Shula to go on to do what they did. But beyond even that compelling story is also the compelling backdrop against which this perfect season is played. A turbulent time in our country's history, and particularly in the city of Miami, where so much of this drama unfolded. Marshall John Fisher may be familiar to you for a previous book called A Terrible Splendor, Three Extraordinary Men, A World Poised for War, and The Greatest Tennis Match Ever Played. This is a book that I sought out a bit after it was published. If I had known at the time, I would have done everything I could have to interview the author, because this is a great book about an amazing moment in tennis history when two of the greatest players played a dramatic match on the eve of the Second World War. So I urge you to seek that out, but also to seek out this wonderful new book published by Abrams Press, again titled 17-0, Miami 1972, and the NFL's only perfect season. Marshall John Fisher, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg. Great to be here.
I'm really, really happy to be talking with you. I should mention that your work has also appeared in many magazines, including The Atlantic, and you have won some distinguished awards for your work, and I think this book is just great. As I mentioned, I was 12 years old at the time of this perfect season unfolding for the Miami Dolphins, and I had just become enamored with the NFL. I was a Pittsburgh Steelers fan. I became fond of them. I liked the emblem on their helmets. So for no better reason than that, they sort of became my team. And it was a propitious timing because that's when they began their ascent. But so that was just in time for me to really pay attention to this amazing season. You were even younger, I think. And
yeah, I was 9 years old in 72. And it's funny you mentioned that because in my earlier years, or not long before that, maybe a couple years before that, I liked the Rams because of their helmet. So when my dad and my brother were just getting into the Dolphins, and we had moved to Miami when I was three, which is right when the Dolphins' first season began, 1966, that my brother and dad were getting into them, and I insisted on being a Rams fan for about 1 year, I think. but in 71 is when I came over to the Dolphins as a big fan, and then, of course, 72.
One of the things that I either heard you say in another interview or maybe at some point you say it in the book is that I think you may have gone about writing this book, which, by the way, I don't think I've actually said it out loud if people haven't done the math, but we are in the 50th anniversary season of this particular season of the Dolphins. So, but that you did so with at least a little bit of trepidation, that is, wondering if that team was as amazing as you remembered it. I mean, as you viewed it through a nine-year-old's eyes. Am I remembering that correctly? And,
yeah,
and tell us a
correct.
Little more about that experience of looking back at events so long ago and looking through them now through the eyes of a seasoned sports journalist.
Right. Well, that's exactly right. That, you know, I always thought of this team as something very, very special. And I think they had a huge impact on everyone living there at the time, but especially kids, you know. It was so amazing to have this perfect team as our team that year. And years later, I wondered, were they really that? Because I had remembered them as this, not just a great football team, but as an unusual group of men who they seemed particularly remarkable to me. And I thought, well, maybe that's just nostalgia, you know. And I mean, I had nostalgia for this team even 10 years after it. I was in college in the 80s, and I was in the creative writing program, and I remember I wrote one of the best stories I wrote in that program in college was called, and actually titled 17-0, and I wrote a short story about a high school senior, which would be older than me, but a kid living in Miami during the perfect season. So even then, it was only about 10 years later, and it was imbued with this nostalgia for this old, you know, this old time, this perfect season. So now, as the 50th anniversary approached, I really wondered, you know, if it was going to live up to my memories, and it really did. I mean, as I researched these guys and this team, they really were a remarkable group of people. They were all sorts of different types. There were the crew cut conservative types, and there were the liberals, you know, campaigning for McGovern, and then you had the party guys with the long sideburns and out drinking all night, and just a lot of different types. But they, under Don Shula, they really came together. He imbued each of them with this mania that he had for getting back to the Super Bowl and winning it. And they really came together as a team, and they were a very intelligent group, is the other thing. And I kind of remembered that, and it was true. They, you know, these guys became doctors and lawyers and successful businessmen, and they really were a smart team. A lot of them were not as big as fast as you might have wanted for the NFL, but they were smart and great athletes as well.
Before we dig into some specifics explored in your book, I want to have you just talk a little bit about the experience of doing your research and what or who was most valuable to you in telling this story so thoroughly. And, of course, it would also be great for us to hear about some of the surviving Dolphins that you were able to actually speak with and whom you acknowledge very enthusiastically at the end of the book.
Yeah, it was a great experience for me researching this book. I was able to reach a number of them, a number of them have passed away, of course, and some are experiencing difficulties with head trauma, brain injuries, you know, that's been a big story about the NFL, and the Dolphins were no exception. A number of them have died of CTE and and other brain injury-related illnesses, and some are suffering. But I was able to reach, I think I interviewed 11 players. And, you know, I was trying to do in this book kind of what I did in A Terrible Splendor, which you were nice enough to mention, which is to bring a lot of different stories together of different people. And, of course, it made perfect sense in this one because of all the different players. You know, there are a lot of players on a team and coaches and other people. So I tell, you know, a little bit about the stories of each of these players, and a lot of them were very interesting, even some you might not remember. One who was very valuable to me was Eddie Jenkins, who hardly played at all. He was, you know, he was a sub. I mean, he was on the taxi squad much of the season, but an interesting person. He became a lawyer later, city attorney for Boston, and he was very interesting and helpful to me because, well, he had an interesting story, first of all, that I put in the book of how he came down for training camp, and he stopped on the way in Miami Beach because the convention, the Democratic National Convention, was going on. Both conventions were held on Miami Beach that year. And he had this amazing experience of seeing cars overturn and fires being lit, all these protesters, people protesting against the war, and, you know, on his way to his first training camp. So, you know, there are a lot of interesting stories of individuals during that season, and that's one of them. Mm-hmm. But the great, you know, it's a great thrill to talk to people who were heroes of mine when I was a kid. You know, Paul Warfield, Mercury Morris, Howard Twilley, you know, and everyone I talked to, they were so amenable to talking and so magnanimous. I mean, Paul Warfield, to me, is, you know, I mean, he's perhaps the greatest wide receiver ever. Even to his teammates at the time, he was sort of on a different level. They sort of treated him with such respect and kid gloves. But he's just the friendliest guy. He gave me a couple hours on the phone, and it was true of all of them. They were all happy to talk, and it was a thrill to talk to them.
Hmm. I know that even as a 9-year-old, you were present for some of the games of this perfect season. I'm just curious, did you take the time 50 years later to watch every game from that perfect season? And I guess maybe parenthetically, I should also ask, I'm just assuming that all of those games are preserved in their entirety, but maybe I'm wrong about that.
Well, I watched a lot of it, a lot of the season. I couldn't get everything. NFL films, I'm sure they do have, but I was unable to get, you know, the footage from NFL films or from the NFL. And I'm sure they do have, I would think they have every game. But, you know, the thing is, I was able to get a lot of it. It's remarkable how much you can see just on YouTube. Several complete games, like including, interestingly, the one game I went to with my dad and my brother was Game 5 against San Diego, and the game where Bob Greasy got hurt and was out for the rest of the regular season. Almost the whole game is on YouTube.
Wow.
The Super Bowl, is on there. I watched the Super Bowl over and over. And I saw a lot of the rest of the season. I was able to piece together footage from different sites. And so I didn't see everything, but I watched a lot of it. And I loved it. To me, that was maybe the most fun of all the research I did. You know, when you have a team you love when you're a kid, it's just to be able to, when you go back and watch all these years later, it's just, to me, that's more fun than watching any game today.
Hmm. We're speaking with Marshall John Fisher about his newest book, 17-0, Miami, 1972, and the NFL's only perfect season. This was a relatively new ball team for the NFL, that is the Miami Dolphins, and what they achieved in their 1972 season has never been duplicated. They went the entire regular season, the playoffs, and the Super Bowl with all victories, no losses, no ties. I appreciate the fact that your book does not limit itself to the Dolphins itself and to the football games that they played, but you also are interested in giving us kind of the backdrop. And you've already touched on a couple of the most remarkable things about the city of Miami at this time, including the fact that in something that's pretty much unprecedented in recent history, they hosted both the Democratic and Republican political conventions that summer. But even quite beyond that, you tell us that there was something about this setting, about Miami at this point in time, that made it, in your words, a setting made for Hollywood. Explain a little more about that backdrop of Miami in 1972. What was going on?
Yeah, it seemed, it really seemed that Miami in some ways was a focal point of so much that was going on in the country. We've talked about how both conventions were there in the summer. Nixon was in Miami a lot because he had the Winter White House down there on Key Biscayne, and I talk quite a bit about Nixon in the book, who, you know, was a fascinating character and a huge football fan. He was the first president who was a really big sports fan. He loved the Redskins, whom the Dolphins ended up playing in the Super Bowl, but he was also a big fan of Don Shula and had written to him several times, and he had even famously suggested a play to Shula for the Super Bowl VI against Dallas, which didn't work out too well. But so Nixon was very much involved in this. Vietnam War was still raging, and, you know, all the protests at the conventions in Miami. And Watergate was getting started. The break-in was that June, and during the football season in the fall, the investigation was just getting going. And even there's a Miami angle because the burglars were, most of them were from Miami. Huh. And Carl Bernstein went down to Miami when he and Woodward were starting to investigate this. He was down in Miami in the late summer trying to, you know, get some interviews and get some information about these guys who broke into the Watergate Hotel. So it is interesting that, you know, and it's one of the things from the very beginning I wanted to do in this book is talk about how Miami was such a big part of what was going on that year.
And I really love how at one point you say that this team, that is the Miami Dolphins, reflected the social dichotomy of the times. Yet, unlike the fractious society seeming to unravel around them, this diverse group found a way to meld seamlessly into a team, the perfect team. And, of course, a lot of your book is all about that.
Yes, I think a big part of that, the credit for that goes to Don Shula. You know, I mean, he really was a great coach, and he really was a great, incredible motivator of men. And he came down there, and there was, you know, Miami was a very different place back then. First of all, it was much smaller, which I talk about. You know, it's nothing like the big city it is today. It was a smaller community, and it was the South. You know, it was, and there was a lot of still a lot of segregation even at the end of the '60s. Black players who came down there were not very comfortable a lot of the time, and they could only buy homes in certain areas. They weren't welcome everywhere. And on the team, you know, they were separated. I mean, in the locker room, the black guys were on one half and the white guys on the other half, and they roomed only with the same race. And Don Shula came down there, and he immediately integrated the team. He assigned roommates, and they were almost all mixed race. And he insisted the locker room be all mixed. He moved all the lockers around. And then, you know, it's not that he was such a great progressive, political guy. He was not interested in that, really. I mean, he cared about winning. And Mercury Morris pointed this out to me. He said, you know, it wasn't that Shula was, in fact, he was sort of middle of the road politically, but I think he was for integration, of course. But he really cared about winning, and he knew that they had to function as a team. And they couldn't be separated like that. So he was amazing, really, at doing that, and he transmitted this desire that he had, this incredible mania for winning, to each of his players.
Right. And in some ways, this forced integration of the Dolphins was, you know, kind of a litmus test for the way in which this kind of highly varied group of men would be able to come together. I mean, across not only racial divides, but political divides and personality divides and so on. And it really happened, although it's not particularly easy. And you also tell...
You know, the interesting thing, though, that just occurred to me is that, of course, you know, you're in Kenosha and in Wisconsin, and Shula was not the first to do this. You know, Vince Lombardi with the Packers had also worked hard to integrate his team, also for similar reasons, you know, this mania for winning and for making a team. And Marv Fleming, who had played for the Packers, came down to Miami in 1970, same year as Shula, and he walked into the locker room, and he couldn't believe it, how segregated the locker room was coming from the Packers. And so he made a big show. He also was part of that because he kind of ridiculed them for that, and, you know, he was a part of integrating that team, too.
Interesting. Yes, and you mentioned in telling this story that that the Miami Dolphins were not the exception. They were more the norm. That is, that kind of racial segregation of the black and white players eating separately, rooming separately, hanging out separately. That was the way it played out on nearly every team. And a team had to make a really concerted effort to break out of that old habit. And you're right. The Packers, thanks to Vince Lombardi, were one of the very first to do that in a meaningful way. And it happened in the Dolphins as well.
Right.
You tell us about Coach John Shula that at this point in time, I don't remember if it's even when he came to Miami or just ahead of that, but you would call him at one point the league's most heralded coach. I mean, he had already enjoyed some great success with the Baltimore Colts, and yet there was something that left him sort of at the second tier in some respects, and that was the fact that before this 1972 season, he had, in a sense, lost two Super Bowls. So he had this reputation of not being able to win the big game. Tell us more about that and how crucial you think that was, or how important that was to Don Shula himself, that reputation, deserved or not.
No way to overstate how important that was to him. He had become the youngest head coach in the NFL when he became the coach of Baltimore in the mid-60s, and he was a great coach. You know, he was considered the best coach, even though he never quite went all the way. He came very close. He lost some big playoff games in Baltimore, but then he finally took them to the NFL championship in 1968. But the thing was, that was the third year that the NFL champion had to play the AFL champion in what was they were calling the Super Bowl. I mean, it was Super Bowl III. They were still separate leagues, but his team kind of relaxed. They didn't take it very seriously because the NFL was supposed to be so much stronger than the AFL. But they lost in humiliating fashion to Joe Namath and the Jets in Super Bowl III. And that was a turning point for Shula. He was ridiculed by his own owner, and his stock really fell in Baltimore. And the next year they had not a great season. And so he was all ears when Miami called, and Joe Robbie wanted to hire him down in Miami. And so he was kind of happy to leave Baltimore and come down to Miami. He immediately took them. And as you say, he was already at that point the most heralded coach in the league. He really was. And first year in Miami, he took this expansion team to the playoffs. Second year to the Super Bowl, but then they had another humiliating loss in Super Bowl VI to Dallas. So now he's this guy who's been the greatest coach and the youngest coach, but he has lost both Super Bowls he's been in, and people were saying he couldn't win the big one. And so he just became obsessed with getting back to the Super Bowl in 1972 and winning it. And you know, Larry Zonka remembered him even saying, "We're going to go out there and we're going to win every game." And he was able, as I've said before, he was able to transmit this to each and every player, and they went along with him for the ride. Mm.
It's important for us to remind our listeners that the Dolphins were a very new team. I think you just called them an expansion team. So yeah. Their first season, was it 1966?
Yes.
So it's not like they were drawing upon any kind of long history or long legacy. And it's also an interesting part of the Don Shula story to talk briefly about the coach whom he followed, one George Wilson, a pretty much forgotten name now. But he was someone, you tell us, who was absolutely loved by his players, and for very good reason. And when he was summarily dumped after the Dolphins went 3-10-1 in their, I think, fourth season, he is fired. And so Don Shula is following in the footsteps of a player who was really beloved and who many of those players felt did not deserve to be fired. And that is not an enviable position for any new coach to find themselves in.
No, and even worse, George Wilson had been Shula's boss. In fact, he had been his boss in Detroit, where Shula got his first coaching job, and when George Wilson was the head coach of Detroit in the 50s. And then George Wilson really helped him get that head coaching job at Baltimore. So, you know, and then he had to come in and replace him when he was fired, and Wilson was not happy about it. But Joe Robbie assured Shula that Wilson was going to be fired in any case. And so Shula took the job. But George Wilson was not a bad coach. You know, he had won the NFL championship when in Detroit when Shula was his assistant. And he was, you know, a good coach, but he was near the end of his career, and he was kind of taking it easy in Miami. And the players loved him because he treated them like, one of his, like his buddies, you know, and he'd party with them, and the practices were not too tough. It was too hot. They'd go swimming in the pool at the college where they were practicing. And, you know, but the players loved him, but he didn't necessarily work them hard enough, at least at that point in his career, to be winners.
One of the things you tell us that's very interesting is about how the Dolphins contacted Don Shula. And although Joe Robbie wanted him, Joe Robbie could not pick up the phone and offer this opportunity to Don Shula. Explain that situation and how that was ultimately handled.
Yeah, well, you're not allowed, even now, you know, it's the same today. I mean, you're not allowed to just contact a player or coach of another team and try to lure them away when they're under contract. So, but the main football writer for the Miami Herald at that time was Bill Broucher, who had gone to college with Don Shula at John Carroll University up in Ohio. And he was talking with Robbie, and he suggested Shula to Robbie. Joe Robbie wanted a coaching change. He was trying to get Bear Bryant from Alabama, but he couldn't quite land him. And Broucher said, why don't you try Shula? I don't think he's too happy up there right now. And as you say, Robbie couldn't call him, but Broucher could call him as a friend, you know. And he called him up and felt him out, and, you know, Shula was kind of interested. So then, but even Shula himself said, I can't talk to Robbie until I get permission from. So he tried to get permission from Carol Rosenblum, the owner, who was away in Asia, or I think he was in Japan. And he couldn't be contacted, so he asked his son, who was the, I guess, the vice president of the team. And his son gave him permission. So Shula was a guy who always played by the rules, you know. I mean, he would not even bend a rule. So he got permission. He felt that was okay, and he met with Robbie a few times, and they came to an agreement. But the thing is, Carol Rosenblum, when he got back, was furious about it, even though he did not like Shula and had been kind of wanting to fire him anyway. But he didn't like that he had been hired out while he was away. So he complained, and in fact, the Dolphins got penalized for tampering. And in the end, they had to give up a draft choice, I think,
wow,
for that. But that's how that all worked out. Yeah.
One of my favorite moments in the book is when you describe the one-day get-acquainted event in April of that year. So this is when Don Shula met nearly all of the veterans who are already part of the Miami Dolphins. And it was not, in a sense, the friendliest of encounters, at least with certain players that Don Shula was meeting for the first time, including the great Larry Little and the amazing running back Larry Zonka. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about here.
Yeah, well, this is in April of 1970, as you say. He'd just been hired, and he comes down for the mini camp to meet players. And they got the idea right away that things were going to be a little different than they were under George Wilson, because Shula seemed obsessed with everyone's weight. Larry Little came up to him and said, "Hi, Coach, I'm your guard, Larry Little." And, you know, and Larry Little had been, you know, if you follow football, you might know now that he was the greatest offensive lineman of the 1970s, and that's what he was voted at the later. But at that time, he was nothing much. He'd played for San Diego, hadn't done very well, and then came to Miami and was, you know, he was pretty good, but he wasn't nothing outrageous. But Shula met him and goes immediately says, "What's your weight?" And Larry, I forget the numbers, but whatever he said, Shula said, "Losing 20 pounds before training camp. Report." He would tell them each what weight to report at. Same thing with Zonka. Zonka told him he was 255, I think, and he goes, "Report at 235." And, you know, Zonka said, "I can't do that. That's my high school weight. How am I going to do that?" And he goes, "You'll be better. You'll be faster." And he did that with a lot of players. And you know what? It really helped. I mean, that Larry Little credits that with really changing the nature of his game, because he was a pulling guard. He had to run. He really had to move to get outside and do what he did, and that helped turn him into a great player. But it's funny, you know, and Shula said how when he was in Baltimore, he tried the same thing with Bubba Smith, the great defensive lineman, and Smith was not, did not like that and never really bought into that. And but the players in Miami did what he told them, and it worked.
Right, but it was not necessarily pleasant in the moment.
Yeah.
You're right. Players felt like the team had been taken over by Weight Watchers rather than a new coach.
And obsessed with the weight, yeah.
Right, and you tell us about the way in which he ran training camp, and at one point one of the players said that there was really no need for bed checks because they would get to bed absolutely exhausted, but they were starting to really be shaped into a very, very fine ball team. You tell us that the reputation of the Dolphins, even as they approached this amazing undefeated season, as kind of a ragtag group in which a lot of the roster consisted of kind of cast-offs from other teams and so on. Is that reputation deserved? I mean, in fact, is that what their roster largely consisted of? I mean, yeah. I mean, more so than would often be the case?
I think so. I mean, it's remarkable when you look at the players. I mean, I just mentioned Larry Little, who he grew up in Miami but was drafted by San Diego, and he was barely even starting at San Diego. He was not considered to be much of a player. So many of them, Bob Kuchenberg, the great left guard, he had been, you know, he didn't make an NFL team, and he was playing semi-pro ball in Chicago for the Chicago Owls. And you know, then he got a tryout in Miami and came down there. The offensive line called themselves the Expendables because they had all, most of them, everyone except Doug Cruzan, who was a number one choice. The rest had been let go by other teams and just not considered to have much promise. And the defense was called the no-name defense for good reason, because other than Nick Bonacani, he had been an all-pro in the AFL for the Patriots, other than them, they were not well known at all, even though they were great. They ended up being great players, but they were people. You know, Doug Swift, the linebacker, came from Amherst College, a little Division III school. Manny Fernandez, who was such a great nose tackle, was not drafted out of Utah, and he just came down and tried out. It's really true of a number of the players, and as I said before, a lot of them, on paper, were not that big or that fast, and so they didn't get a lot of look from other players, other coaches. But they were, they had heart, and they had. They had talent, and they had smarts, and Shula was able to see that in them. And also his coaches, Monty Clark and Schnellenberger and Arnsparger, were also really remarkable, and they were able to see in players what other coaches had not seen.
Hmm. You tell us that the training camp for Don Shula's first two seasons were marked by kind of outside, well, and sometimes inside trouble. Some kind of strike, I think, the first time out, and an important holdout for the second training camp. So in both of those instances, we're talking about training camp beginning with at least some complications in the air.
Yes. The first season, there was a strike. The NFL players were trying to get better better pay and better contracts, and they had a strike, so the veterans didn't report for quite a while, and that's why that allowed some players to get in and make it. Someone like Doug Swift, who I just mentioned, really probably got in there because there were no veterans in camp, and so there was room for more people who hadn't played to come in and get tryouts and to show what they had, you know. But the veterans all reported quite late, I think 2 weeks before the first exhibition game, so that's what led to this this boot camp, this training camp, where Shula instituted four-a-day practices, which, you know, is very unusual. The players, they'll talk about that to this day, how brutal it was. Just you know, and you said they couldn't wait to get to bed, and then someone else told me, you know, couldn't wait to get to bed. But on the other hand, you didn't want to go to bed because you knew next thing you know, you're getting up and starting again. It was just a rough training camp because of that delay. The second season, I think you're referring to Kick and Zonka, who held out. The two, you know, the starting backfield, Butch and Sundance, as they were called, and they decided they had done the outrageous move of getting an agent to negotiate their contracts for them, which most players did not have at that time. And the agent had them sit out, and so they were getting fined every day. They weren't there. And Shula later said that was what made it difficult for him to institute the three-back offense with Mercury Morris, which he said he had wanted to do. I'm not sure why that made it that hard, but that was his reason. But in any case, it certainly was big news back then. And finally, Kick and Zonker finally signed for a big raise. And Kick said to the reporter who asked him, we would have played for nothing, but, you know, we just wanted to get some more money.
Right. And you're, of course, referring to Larry Zonka and Jim Kick, who were already very, very well known. And then this complication comes along in the form of a brilliantly talented running back named Mercury Morris. And as you're just touching on, Coach Shula had to figure out a way to meld him into that backfield and make use of his spectacular talents as well. And that's just one of a number of kind of dicey situations. Another that you tell us about is how the man who ultimately became the center for the Miami Dolphins, Jim Langer, was somebody who was not particularly prominent or successful for his first couple of years. I think you tell us he barely remained on the team and then somehow was able to supplant the incumbent and went on to become one of the greatest centers that the NFL's ever seen. I mean, it's an incredible story.
Yeah, you know, it's another one of these guys who was just not considered to have much promise. He had been drafted by Cleveland, I think, and they let him go, or the Dolphins signed him into the taxi squad. And yeah, even in training camp in 72, he'd already been there a couple of years, but he was just a backup. All through the exhibition season, no one thought he'd be starting because they had Bob DeMarco, who was a good center. He had been the center last few years in the Super Bowl the year before. And but Monty Clark, this brilliant offensive line coach they had, who was quite a character himself. He was a poet and a musician, interested in all kinds of things. And he liked Langer. He liked what he was seeing from Jim Langer. And even though Shula Kitt and everyone was telling the press all through the preseason that, no, DeMarco's our man, you know, our center. But Monty Clark kept saying to Shula, you got to keep looking at Langer. He's amazing. And, by the end of the preseason, Shula had to tell DeMarco that he had lost his job to this kid, Jim Langer. And DeMarco was furious and demanded to be traded, and he was traded to Cleveland. And as you say, Jim Langer became one of the very greatest centers ever. I think he was also named on the best team of the 70s, you know, the best center of the 1970s.
And from what you describe, and we glean from the quotes of him, that he seems like a really sweet Midwestern kid who, his admiration for Bob DeMarco was, surpassed everyone. I mean, and he was amazed and incredibly gratified to be given this opportunity, and he made the most of it. I appreciate that you remind us that this is an era in football when, in your words, NFL players were not yet millionaires nor treated as millionaires. They were more like indentured servants. And so it's probably important for us in 2022 to be reminded of what life was like for the NFL and NFL players 50 years ago. At any rate, Don Shula is able to achieve a 10-4 season, his first season with the Dolphins, 10-3-1 the second, and they make it to the Super Bowl, but they get their tails whipped by the Dallas Cowboys. 6 months later, when the Dolphins reconvene, describe what Don Shula did in that first meeting with his players at the very outset.
Yeah, well, even to go back further, right after the game, he assembled his team and he said, think about how you feel right now and make sure you don't never feel this way again. And Vern Den Herter, the defensive lineman, told me that even on the plane home from the Super Bowl, he was walking up and down the aisle talking to each player and saying the same thing. Make sure next year we're never going to feel this way. Think about what you're going to do to change this and take us that one extra step. And then, first day of training camp, they get there, and he's immediately playing them the films from the Super Bowl loss, and going over it, and the players are looking at each other, oh, man, what are we in for? Because Shula was just so driven at this point. And as I said before, Zonka remembers, he's the only one who remembers this, but he remembers Shula saying, we're going to go out there each week, and we're going to win every single game. And, you know, he turned to Kick, Jim Kick, next to him, and they just looked at each other, and one of them said, oh, boy, this is going to be a beauty.
Right. And I like how you
boot camp with him.
Right. And you quote Mercury Morris saying something to the effect that, you know, he's here he is reaming them out as though the game just happened 24 hours earlier. I mean, it's six months ago, but Don Shula intends to use the pain and anger and frustration of that humiliating loss to fuel his team to achieve something that had never been achieved before and which has never been achieved since. Well, ultimately, of course, the balance of your book takes us game by game through this incredible season. We should say that it is not a season of one blowout after another. There are a couple of different games that are very, very close, at least one game that's won by the Dolphins by a single point. So it is by no means an easy season, nor a charmed season, especially because of what happens in game five when quarterback Bob Greasy goes down with an injury that takes him out for the remainder of the season. And the thought that the Dolphins could go on winning without Bob Greasy is just astounding. Tell our listeners about the veteran quarterback who stepped in so ably into his shoes.
Yes, and as I said, that was the one game that my family went to, and we watched Greasy go down with the broken ankle and get carted off on a stretcher, and there was this feeling that, oh, no, there goes the season, because, you know, when you lose your all-pro quarterback, not many teams can come back from that. But Shula had been smart enough to bring down Earl Morrill as the backup for that year. And Morrill had been his backup quarterback for him in Baltimore for several years. And, in fact, in 1968, Johnny Unitas was out for the whole season, and Morrill played almost the entire season and took the Colts to a 15-1 season and the NFL championship, although they then lost, as I said, to the Jets in the Super Bowl. So Morrill had done it before. But in 1972, he was 38 years old, by far the oldest player on the team. He was older than some of his coaches, almost as old as Shula. And he was just this laid-back guy. He was one of these conservative crew-cut guys. You know, he looked like it was 1958 all the time. But he certainly didn't reflect the times of the early 70s in Miami. But he just got along with everyone, and he was very laid-back, didn't feel any pressure. And when he had to come in that Game 5, and he just got out to the huddle, and the players were all, you know, just kind of downcast. But what had happened, he just said, all right, guys, let's just keep it going. And he took him down. He threw a couple touchdown passes, won the game. And, you know, he won 11 games for them. And, in fact, he was the number one passer in the league that year. And he was the all-pro quarterback, even though, in the end, he didn't get to play in the Super Bowl.
Hmm. And, again, your book takes us game by game. And it's so interesting, even though the title of your book is 17-0, and we obviously know this book was written because they went 17-0, it's amazing how much suspense you're able to fold into the mix as you recount each and every one of these games, some of which are blowouts, but most of which are hard-fought and close, as are the playoff games which occur then, with a victory over the Cleveland Browns and then my own beloved Pittsburgh Steelers, a really close game that I remember watching. The Dolphins beat the Steelers at home in Three River Stadium, setting up the Super Bowl with the Washington Redskins. I could hardly believe my eyes when I read that the Dolphins, despite having a perfect season up to that point, were only one-point favorites over the Redskins. How can that possibly be true?
Yeah, there's several surprising things when you look back. First of all, the Steelers game in the AFC Championship, Dolphins were 15-0 going in, right? And they had to travel up to Pittsburgh and play away because back then the home field didn't go to the better record. The divisions took turns who would get the home field advantage. So that's why that was played in Three River Stadium.
Interesting.
They had to go up there and play with a very hostile crowd, famously hostile crowd up there, and beat the Steelers up there. Then they go to the Super Bowl, and yeah, Jimmy the Greek picks the Redskins by a point, even though Miami's 16-0. You know, and not every, there were some experts who picked the Dolphins, but several picked the Redskins because they were a more experienced team and they thought they had a tougher schedule. So they always felt like they were up against them. They were the underdogs, and I think that gave them a little extra fire. But they really handled the Redskins, beat them pretty badly, even though the final score doesn't show it, 14-7, because of the famous goof by Gary Apremian. But if he had made that easy field goal near the end, it would have been 17-0 for a 17-0 season.
Right. It's interesting what a big difference there is between 17-0 as a score versus 14-7. For our listeners who don't recall, Gary Apremian, was it that the snap was fumbled or
no? He kicked it very low and it blocked.
He actually
kicked it into the back of the lineman, I believe, and then it came back to him. And instead of falling on it, he tried to throw a pass. It went straight up in the air. And when it came back down, he made it even worse by batting it up like a volleyball for some reason, back up into the air. And finally, Mike Bass of the Redskins grabbed it and went the other way for a touchdown.
Right. That I remember. I just didn't remember exactly the circumstances. Yeah. The other thing I remember is a night or two later, Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show, my recollection is he opened his opening monologue by saying, you know, first of all, I have a quick announcement. The Gary Apremian passing clinic has been indefinitely postponed.
Right.
I feel like that's the first time I ever understood, you know, kind of an adult level joke as a youngster. But aside from that embarrassing little moment, it is a entirely convincing victory by the Miami Dolphins over the Redskins, and this perfect season is ultimately achieved. They don't achieve perfection the following season, but in some respects, that next Miami Dolphins team is equal to the one that achieved this perfect season, at least in terms of sheer ability, it sounds like.
Yeah, or even better. You know, the funny thing about is that you can't even say that the 72 Dolphins were the greatest team ever because they weren't even the greatest Miami team ever. Most players and observers felt that the 73 team was a better team. And as you say, the games in that season were mostly blowouts. They did lose a very close one early on to Oakland, out in Oakland, 12-7. And then they lost the last game of the season in a game that didn't matter when they rested a lot of players. Other than that, they really kind of destroyed everyone, and especially in the playoffs, whereas, as you mentioned, in 72, the playoff games were pretty close. In 73, they were not. They just destroyed Cincinnati and then Oakland. They got revenge on Oakland. And then in the Super Bowl, they really killed Minnesota pretty badly, and they hardly even had to throw the ball. As great a passing game as they had with Paul Warfield and Bob Greasy was a terrific quarterback, they hardly threw it all that year. I mean, I think he threw six passes in the AFC Championship and six more in the Super Bowl. So they were just so dominant on the ground.
Amazing. In our last minute or so, what has it meant for you as a longtime Dolphins fan to be able to go on this odyssey of in a sense, journeying back half a century and reliving this amazing season?
Yeah, it's been really gratifying for me. As I said, I've been thinking about it for so long, and I think I mentioned that I first wrote about them when I was in college. And all these years, I knew at some point I had to write something about this team that I'd grown up with and that had left such an impression on me. And finally, with the 50th anniversary, it's hard to believe, with that coming up, I finally realized this is the time, and a few years ago started work on this. And it's just been great, and it was great talking to players and hearing from people who also remember that team, and friends and other fans, and just glad I was able to finally get it done for the 50th anniversary.
It's an incredible book. It really, really is, and I appreciate so much that we learn about this team as a whole and the remarkable players that were on its roster who played such an important role in various ways in making all of this happen. The book again, 17-0, Miami, 1972, and the NFL's only perfect season. The book published by Abrams Press, and it includes some wonderful photographs as well, and the wonderful writing of Marshall John Fisher. Marshall John Fisher, thank you so much. Congrats on a wonderful book, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Greg, thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking with you.
And tomorrow on the morning show, several more noteworthy author interviews that were recorded and initially broadcast last year. One of them with Cody Keenan, who served for a time in the administration of then-President Barack Obama as his head speechwriter. Also, a memorable conversation with Steve Binder, who was the producer for Elvis Presley's massively popular and important TV comeback in 1968. He's written a wonderful book taking us behind the scenes of that historic moment in Elvis Presley's career. That and more will be coming up on the Friday morning show.